36.
We three sank through the roof into the white stone home.
It was several degrees cooler there, and smelled of old leaves and mold.
And of the gentleman, slightly.
We are here by grace, the Reverend said, our ability to abide far from assured. Therefore we must conserve our strength, restricting our activities to only those which directly serve our central purpose. We would not wish through profligate activity to appear ungrateful for the mysterious blessing of our continued abiding, for we are here, but for how long or by what special dispensation, it is not ours to—
Several of Mr. Bevan's many eyes, I noted, were rolling.
Waiting for the Reverend to dismount from his high horse, Mr. Volman was amusing himself by repeatedly placing a pebble on his tremendous member and watching it tumble down.
We must look out for ourselves, the Reverend said, and by doing so we protect the boy as well. He must hear nothing of this rumor, which would only serve to raise his hopes. As we know, only utter hopelessness will lead him to do what he must. Therefore not a word. Are we in agreement? We mumbled our assent.
Lacking the necessary spring in his ancient legs, he had come here already quite old, the Reverend began clawing his way up one wall and soon, though not that soon, vanished through the ceiling.
Leaving Mr. Bevins and me there below, alone.
In truth, we were bored, so very bored, so continually bored.
Each night passed with a devastating sameness.
We had sat every branch on every tree, had read and reread every stone, had walked down, run down, crawled down, laid upon every walk, path, and weedy trail, had waded every brook, possessed a comprehensive knowledge of the textures and tastes of the four distinct soil types here, had made a thorough inventory of every hairstyle, costume, hairpin, watch fob, sock brace, and belt worn by our compatriots. I had heard Mr. Volman's story many thousands of times, and had, I fear, told him my own at least as many times.
In short, it was dull here, and we craved the slightest variation.
Anything new was a treasure. We longed for any adventure, the merest lark.
There would be no harm, we thought, in taking a quick trip.
Out to where the gentleman sat.
We need not even tell the Reverend we were going. We could just go.
It was always a relief to be free of the old bore for a bit.
37.
Bursting out through the front wall, Mr. Bevins and I set off,
ignoring the Reverend's peevish cries of protest from the roof.
Cutting down through the clover-engorged dell occupied by the seven flood-sickened members of the Palmer family, we shortly reached that thin gray-slate trail that runs below, passing between Coates on one side and Wemberg on the other.
Wended our way past Federley, blessed are those who die in the light.
A chess-piece-looking monument, topped with a vase that ends in what looks like a nipple.
It proceeded to the M. Boyden G. Boyden Gray Hebbard cluster.
Into that slight hollow which is, in spring, overgrown with foxglove and cone flower.
But was now a massive, dormant tangle of gray.
Wherein two slothful winter birds glared at us as we passed.
Birds being distrustful of our ilk.
Jogging down the far side of the North Hill, we greeted Merkel, kicked by a bull but still looking forward to the dance, Posterbell, a dandy whose looks had gone, who fervently wished that his hair might be restored and his gums might reverse their recession and the muscles of his arms might no longer resemble flaccid straps, and his dinner suit be brought to him, and a bottle of scent and a bouquet of flowers, so that he might once again go courting. Mr. and Mrs. West, fire with no possible cause, as they were always meticulously careful regarding management of the hearth, and Mr. Dill, mumbling contentedly about his grandson's excellent university marks, eagerly anticipating the spring graduation.
And proceeded past Trevor Williams, former hunter, seated before the tremendous heap of all the animals he had dispatched in his time, hundreds of deer, 32 black bear, 3 bear cubs, innumerable coons, lynx, foxes, mink, chipmunks, wild turkeys, woodchucks and cougars, scores of mice and rats, a positive tumble of snakes, hundreds of cows and calves, 1 pony, carriage struck, 20,000 or so insects, each of which he must briefly hold with loving attention for a period ranging from several hours to several months, depending on the quality of loving attention he could muster and the state of fear the beast happened to have been in at the time of its passing. Being thus held, the product of time and loving attention being found sufficient, that is, that particular creature would heave up, then trot or fly or squirm away, diminishing Mr. Williams' heap by 1.
It was an extraordinary pile, nearly as tall as the chapel spire.
He had been a prodigious hunter and had many years of hard work yet ahead of him.
He called out to us, arms full of calf, asking us to keep him company, saying that his was good toil but lonely, as he was not permitted to ever stand and stroll about.
I explained to him that we were on an urgent mission and must not delay.
Mr. Williams, a good sort, never unhappy, always cheerful, since his conversion to gentleness, acknowledged that he understood by waving 1 hoof of the calf.
38.
Soon we approached the massive collier sick home of Italian marble, encircled by 3 concentric rose gardens, marked on either side by an ornate fountain, waterless now for winter.
When one owns 4 homes and has 15 full-time gardeners perfecting one's 7 gardens and 8 man-made streams, one will, of necessity, spend a great deal of time racing between homes and from garden to garden, and so it is perhaps not surprising if, one afternoon, rushing to check on the progress of a dinner one's cook is preparing for the board of one's favorite charity, one finds oneself compelled to take a little rest, briefly dropping to one knee, then both knees, then pitching forward onto one's face, and, unable to rise, proceeding here for a more prolonged rest, only to find it not restful at all, since, while ostensibly resting, one finds oneself continually fretting about one's carriages, gardens, furniture, homes, et al., all of which, one hopes, patiently await one's return, not having, heaven forfend, fallen into the hands of some reckless, careless, undeserving other.
Percival Dash Collier.
Mr. Collier, shirt clay-stained at the chest from his fall, nose crushed nearly flat, was constantly compelled to float horizontally, like a human compass needle, the top of his head facing in the direction of whichever of his properties he found himself most worried about at the moment. The top of his head was now facing west. Our arrival, causing his worrying to wane, he let out an involuntary gasp of pleasure, bobbed up to vertical, and turned to face us.
"Mr. Collier," said Mr. Volman. "Mr. Volman," said Mr. Collier.
A new property worry then crossing his mind, he was thrown violently forward, stomach down, and with a grunt of dread spun to face north.
39.
Next, we must shortcut through that swampy little section populated by our very lowest.
They sought the damp and moonless feeling here.
Here stood Mr. Randall and Mr. Twood in perpetual conversation,
rendered mutually inarticulate by we knew not what misfortune.
Faces reduced to gauzy, unreadable smudges.
Torsos gray and shapeless, but for the slightest torpedo-shaped suggestion of arms and legs.
Indistinguishable, except that Mr. Twood's movements retained a touch more vitality. Every now and then, as if making an attempt at persuasion, one of his arm-like appendages would pop up, as if to indicate on a shelf something to which he wished to call Mr. Randall's attention.
Mr. Twood having been, we believed, in the retail line.
"Drag out the big signage. Immediately put it away again. Drag it out again. Not let slip from grasp. Significantly reduced women's."
Mr. Benjamin Twood.
In response, the gray, faceless wedge that had been Mr. Randall would sometimes enact a little dance.
Yield the seat. Here's a fellow who can really tinkle the twinklers, and the bloke at the piano would proffer his, and it was all me.
Jasper Randall.
Sometimes near sunrise, when all the other swamp denizens were weary and depleted and had self-stacked and gone mute near the lightning-blasted black oak, Mr. Randall could be found bowing over and over again, as if to an imagined audience.
Leading us to surmise that he must have been a performer of some type.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Extraordinary value within. Only recall your thin, weary mother, who might yet be saved by the auto iron, the cranking grater, the cold box, the auto salter, her once fine posture revived, her winsome, kind smile revived, as of yore, when, in short knees, you sported a branch saber among the general pie odor.
Slam arpeggio pause for smoke drink. When I slammed a good one, small ripples would appear in the golden drink set before.
Any admiration we might once have felt for their endurance had long since devolved into revulsion.
Were we destined for a similar fate?
We thought not.
Regularly scanned each other's features for any indication of facial smudging.
Continually monitored ourselves for the slightest degradation in diction.
And they were far from the worst.
Consider Mr. Papers.
Essentially a cringing gray supine line.
Of whom one would only become aware once one had stumbled over him.
Could Harry any help, mate? Come. To heap me. Can Harry help? Can any wonder? Help. Can I get you an heap? Unclog? May. Please help me.
L.B. Papers.
We had no idea what Mr. Papers might previously have been.
There being so little of him remaining.
Go on, move along, else receive an unglad message and you're bent over. I'll come right up under and ventilate your under-tenting.
Flanders Quinn.
Former robber.
Bevins. I'll piss a line of toxic in your wretched twin wrist cuts. Gropping you by your club dick, Valmon, I'll slang you into the black fence.
I, for one, was afraid of him.
I was not afraid of him. Exactly. But we had urgent business. Must not linger.
And Trot skimmed off along the swamp margin, Quinn cursing us, then reversing himself and supplicating us to return, as he was frightened to stay in that place, and yet more frightened to leave it and go. Since what must become of a sinner who had slit the throats of a merchant and his daughter beside a broken-wheeled Fredericksburg carriole, plucked the pearls from her very neck and wiped them blood-free with her own silk wrap?
Regaining higher ground, we put on the speed, passed through the leaning tool shed, crossed the gravel road, and made good time along the old carriage path, which still retained, to my nostrils, some faint, mysterious scent of newsprint.
40.
Just ahead now, past the slightly left-leaning Cafferty obelisk, a crowd had gathered around a freshly filled sick hole.
Mr. Volman approached the group. Is the new arrival still with us? He delicately inquired. He is, yes, replied Tobin, Badger, Muller, bent as always nearly double with toil. Shut your traps so I can hear 'em, barked Mrs. Sparks on all fours, ear to the ground.
41.
Wife of my heart, Laura, Laura, I take up my pen in a state of such great exhaustion that only my deep love for all of you could so compel me after a day of such unholy slaughter and fear. I must tell you frankly that Tom Gilman did not make it through the terrible fight. Our position being located in a copse, much firing during which I heard a cry, Tom is hit and fallen, our brave and noble friend laying upon his face upon the ground. I directed the boys that we would avenge even if it meant stepping through the very gates of hell. Such is the state of my mind that though I know we set off in that direction and with that intent, what happened next I cannot recall. Only that all is well, and I embrace my faithful pen to inform you I am at present safe and hope these lines find my dear little family enjoying the same great blessing. I arrived here at this place by distant journey and confined all the while. It was a terrible fight, as I believe I wrote you. Tom Gilman is dead, as I believe I wrote you. But he who preserves or destroys by his whim saw fit to preserve me to write these lines to you, to say that although confined, I count my blessings. I am weary to the point I can scarcely tell where I am or how I got here. I await the nurse. Trees hang down, breeze blows. I am somewhat blue and afraid. Oh, my dear, I have a foreboding, and I feel I must not linger in this place of great sadness. He who preserves and loves us scarcely present. And since we must endeavor always to walk beside him, I feel I must not linger, but am confined in mind and body, and unable, as if manacled, to leave at this time, dear wife. I must seek and seek. What is it that keeps me in this abysmal, sad place?
Captain William Prince.
A figure now burst up from the mounded earth like some wild creature sprung from a cage and began pacing about, anxiously gazing into the faces of Mr. Muller, Mrs. Sparks, and the others.
A soldier. In uniform.
Don't be afraid, someone drawled from the crowd. You was in that old place, and now you was in this new place here.
The soldier became translucent to the point of invisibility, as sometimes happens with us during intense cogitation, and, head first, re-entered the sick hole. Then of the instant was out again, look of bleak wonderment upon his face.
Dear wife of my heart, O Laura Bunny, inside my confinement is my trappings. I have just now looked, my cheek mole and hairline exact. It is uncomfortable to behold. With a sad look on the burned face, the torso marred by a grave wound difficult to... I am here, am trapped here, and I see of this instant what I must do to get free, which is tell the truth, and all shall be... Oh, I can't tell. Shall I tell? Shall I tell all? I feel I must, or stay forever in this drear and awful... Laura, send the little ones away and see that they cannot hear what comes next. I consorted with the smaller of the two, I did, in that rude hamlet. Consorted with the smaller of the two, and she asked after the locket you had given me, and asked is she a good wife? Even as she, atop me, gave a little thrust of the hips, and looked me in the eye as to disgrace your honor. But I assure you that, even as she thrust twice more, eyes still locked on mine, I did not give her that satisfaction. Did not sully your name or memory, although to serve truth, and thereby escape this place, I feel I must freely confess that as she bent low to proffer her womanly charms, one of them, and then the other, to my mouth, asking, did my wife do this? Was my wife as wild? I made an expulsion of breath that we both understood to mean, no, my wife does not. My wife is not as free. And all the further time we consorted there in that dirty leaning shed, where her three babes did sleep on in their crude crib, and her two pale sisters and her mother did cackle from the yard. She kept the locket clenched in one hand, and when done, asked could she keep it? But my foul lust now wrung out of me, I answered sharply that she could not, and took me to the woods where I wept, and there thought with true tenderness of you, and decided it was kinder to deceive. To deceive you.
He was pacing a wide, stumbling circle now, head and hands.
The moon was high, and I said to myself, sometimes a man must preserve the peace and spare the one he loves, which I have done, until now. I planned to tell you this not in a letter, but in person, when perhaps the warmth of the telling might soften the blow. But my situation appearing hopeless in the extreme, my homecoming now never to occur, I tell all to you. Cry out to you in truest voice. I fucked the smaller of the two. I did it. In hopes that you, and he who hears and forgives all will hear and forgive all, and allow me now to leave this wretched.
Then a blinding flash of light came from near the obelisk, and the familiar yet always bone-chilling fire sound associated with the matter-light-blooming phenomenon.
And he was gone.
His shabby uniform pants raining down, and his shirt, and his boots, and his cheap iron wedding ring.
Some of the lesser members of the gathered crowd now began running amok, mocking at the soldier, inflicting various perverse and disrespectful postures upon his sick mound. Not out of meanness, for there is no meanness in them, but rather from excess of feeling. In this, they can be like wild dogs let into a slaughterhouse, racing about upon the spilled blood, driven mad by the certainty that some sort of satisfaction must be near at hand.
My goodness, I thought, poor fellow. You did not give this place a proper chance, but fled it recklessly, leaving behind forever the beautiful things of this world. And for what? You do not know. A most unintelligent wager. Forgoing eternally, sir, such things as, for example, two fresh-shorn lambs bleat in a new-mown field. Four parallel blind-cast linear shadows creep across the sleeping tabby's midday flank. Down a bleached slate roof and into a patch of wilting heather bounce nine gust-loosened acorns. Up past the shaving fellow wafts the smell of a warming griddle. An early morning pot clangs and kitchen girl chatter. In a nearby harbor, a mansion-sized schooner tilts to port, sent so by a flag-rippling, chime-inciting breeze that causes, in the portside schoolyard, a chorus of childish squeals and the mad barking of what sounds like a dozen...
Friend, now is hardly the time.
Many apologies. But as I believe you must know, the thing is not entirely under my control.
The crowd, having suspended its perversities, stood gaping at Mr. Bevins, who had acquired in the telling such a bounty of extra eyes, ears, noses, hands, etc., that he now resembled some overstuffed fleshly bouquet. Bevins applied his usual remedy, closing the eyes and stopping as many of the noses and ears as he could with the various extra hands, dulling thereby all sensory intake, thus quieting the mind. And multiple sets of the eyes, ears, noses, and hands retracted or vanished. I could never tell which. The crowd returned to its abuse of the soldier's sick mound. Badger Muller pretending to piss upon it, Mrs. Sparks, squatting over it, screwing her face into an ugly grimace. "Look here," she grunted, "I leave the coward a gift."
42.
And we proceeded on.
Walk skimming between, or over, when unavoidable, the former home places of so many fools no longer among us.
Goodson, Reynolds, Slocum, Mackey, Van Dyke, Pieser, Slider, Peck, Safko, Swift, Roseboom.
For example.
Simpkins, Warner, Persons, Lanier, Dunbar, Schumann, Hollingshead, Nelson, Black, Van Dusen.
These were, it must be conceded, in the majority, outnumbering our ilk by perhaps an order of magnitude.
Toppendale, Hagerdown, Messerschmitt, Brown.
Underscoring the exceptional qualities of those of us who soldiered on.
Coe, Mumford, Risley, Rowe, their places were so quiet, and from these, at dusk, as we whirled out of our respective home places, nothing whirled out whatsoever, and the contents of their
sick boxes
lay down there, inert, discarded, neglected.
Regrettable.
Like discarded horses waiting in vain for beloved riders to return.
Edgemont, Toady, Blazengame, Free.
Habernot, Bueller, Darby, Kerr.
These were a chirpy, tepid, desireless sort, generally, and had lingered, if at all, for only the briefest of moments, so completely satisfactory, had they found their tenure in that previous place.
Smiling, grateful, gazing about themselves in wonder, favoring us with a last fond look as they
surrendered,
succumbed,
capitulated.
43.
We found the gentleman as had been described to us, near Bellingweather, husband father shipwright,
sitting cross-legged and defeated in a patch of tall grass.
As we approached, he lifted head from hands and heaved a great sigh. He might have been, in that moment, a sculpture on the theme of loss.
"Shall we?" Mr. Volman said. I hesitated. "The Reverend would not approve," I said. "The Reverend is not here," he said.
44.
In order to occupy the greatest percentage of the gentleman's volume, I lowered myself into his lap and sat cross-legged, just as he was sitting.
The two now comprised one sitting man, Mr. Volman's great girth somewhat overflowing the gentleman, his massive member existing wholly outside the gentleman, pointing up at the moon.
It was quite something. Quite something in there. "Bivens, come in," I called out. "This is not to be missed."
I went in, assuming the same cross-legged posture.
And the three of us were one.
So to speak.
45.
There was a touch of prairie about the fellow.
Yes.
Like stepping into a summer barn late at night.
Or a musty plains office where some bright candle still burns.
Vast. Windswept. New. Sad.
Spacious, curious, doom-minded, ambitious.
Back slightly out.
Right boot chafing.
The recent entry of the youthful Mr. Bivens now caused the gentleman a mild thought swerve, back to a scene from his own wild youth. A soft-spoken but retrograde, dirty cheeks, kind eyes, lass, leading him shyly down a muddy path, nettles accruing on her swaying green skirt, as, in his mind at the time, a touch of shame rose up, having to do with his sense that this girl was not really fair game, i.e. was more beast than lady, i.e. did not even know how to read.
Becoming aware of that which he was remembering, the man's face reddened, we could feel it reddening, at the thought that he was, in the midst of this tragic circumstance, remembering such a sordid incident.
And he hurriedly directed his our mind elsewhere, so as to leave this inappropriate thought behind.
46.
Tried to see his boy's face.
Couldn't.
Tried to hear the boy's laugh.
Couldn't.
Attempted to recall some particular incident involving the boy and hoped this might—
First time we fitted him for a suit. Thus thought the gentleman. This did the trick. First time we fitted him for a suit. He looked down at the trousers and then up at me, amazed, as if to say, "Father, I'm wearing grown-up pants." Shirtless, barefoot, pale round belly like an old man's. Then the little cuffed shirt and buttoning it up. "Goodbye, little belly. We are inshirting you now." "Inshirting? I do not believe that is even a word, Father." I tied the little tie, spun him around for a look. "We have dressed up a wild savage, looks like," I said. He made the growling face. His hair stuck straight up, his cheeks were red. Racing around that store just previous, he had knocked over a rack of socks. The tailor, complicit, brought out the little jacket with much pomp. Then the shy, boyish smile as I slid the jacket on him. "Say," he said, "don't I look fine, Father?" Then no thought at all for a while, and we just looked about us. Bare trees, black against the dark blue sky. "Little jacket, little jacket, little jacket." This phrase sounded in our head. A star flickered off, then on. "Same one he is wearing back in there now." "Huh. Same little jacket. But he who is wearing it is..." I so want it not to be true. Broken. Pale, broken thing. Why will it not work? What magic word made it work? Who is the keeper of that word? What did it profit him to switch this one off? What a contraption it is. How did it ever run? What spark ran it? Grand little machine, set up just so, receiving the spark, it jumped to life. What put out that spark? What a sin it would be. Who would dare? Ruin such a marvel. Hence is murder anathema. God forbid I should ever commit such a grievous.
Something then troubling us.
We ran one hand roughly over our face, as if attempting to suppress a notion just arising.
This effort not proving successful.
The notion washed over us.
47.
Young Willie Lincoln was laid to rest on the day that the casualty lists from the Union victory at Fort Donelson were publicly posted, an event that caused a great shock among the public at that time, the cost in life being unprecedented thus far in the war.
In Setting the Record Straight, Memoir, Error, and Evasion by Jason Tum, Journal of American History.
The details of the losses were communicated to the president even as young Willie lay under embalmment.
Iverness, Opsit.
More than 1,000 troops on both sides were killed, and 3 times that number wounded. It was a most bloody fight, a young Union soldier told his father. So devastating to his company that despite the victory, he remained sad, lonely, and downhearted. Only 7 of the 85 men in his unit survived.
Goodwin, Opsit.
The dead at Donelson, sweet Jesus, heaped and piled like threshed wheat, 1 on top of 2 on top of 3. I walked through it after with a bad feeling. Lord, it was me done that, I thought.
In These Battle Memories by First Lieutenant Daniel Brower.
1,000 dead. That was something new. It seemed a real war now.
In The Great War as Described by Its Warriors by Marshall Turnbull.
The dead lay as they had fallen, in every conceivable shape, some grasping their guns as though they were in the act of firing, while others, with a cartridge in their icy grasp, were in the act of loading. Some of the countenances wore a peaceful, glad smile, while on others rested a fiendish look of hate. It looked as though each countenance was the exact counterpart of the thoughts that were passing through the mind when the death messenger laid them low. Perhaps that noble-looking youth with the smiling, upturned face, with his glossy ringlets matted with his own lifeblood, felt a mother's prayer stealing over his senses as his young life went out. Near him lay a young husband with a prayer for his wife and little one yet lingering on his lips. Youth and age, virtue and evil, were represented on those ghastly countenances. Before us lay the charred and blackened remains of some who had been burnt alive. They were wounded too badly to move, and the fierce elements consumed them.
In The Civil War Years, a Day-by-Day Chronicle of the Life of a Nation, edited by Robert E. Denny, account of Corporal Lucius W. Barber, Company D, 15th Illinois Volunteer Infantry, combatant at Fort Donelson.
I had never seen a dead person before. Now I saw my fill. One poor lad had frozen solid in the posture of looking down aghast at his wound, eyes open. Some of his insides had spilled out and made, there on his side, under a thin coat of ice, a blur of purple and red. At home on my dressing table was a holy card of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and this fellow looked like that. Only his bulge of red and purple was lower and larger, and off to one side, and him gazing down at it in horror.
In That Terrible Glory, a collection of Civil War letters from the men who fought it, compiled and edited by Brian Bell and Libby Trust.
And Mother Fire had swept through the frozen dead and hurt where they lay. We found one still kicking among them and was able to bring him back still alive, not even knowing which side he was on. So burned was he, and naked except for one leg of his pants. I never did hear how he made out, but it did not look hopeful for that poor devil.
In Letters of an Illinois Soldier, edited by Sam Westfall, account of Private Edward Gates, Company F, 15th Illinois Volunteer Infantry.
Two or three of us would grab a fellow and haul him away just as we found him, as it was cold and the bodies were completely froze. That day I learned a person can get used to anything. Soon it all seemed normal to us, and we even joked about it, making up names for each, depending on how it looked. There was bent over, there was shocked, this was half boy.
Brower, upset.
We found two little fellers holding hands, couldn't have been more than 14, 15 apiece, as if they had decided to pass through that dark portal together.
Gates, upset.
How many more dead do you attend to make, sir, afore you is done? One minute, there was our little Nate on that bridge with a fish pole, and where is that boy now? And who is it called him hither in that notice he saw down to Orbeez? Well, sir, that was your name he saw upon it, Abraham Lincoln.
In Country Letters to President Lincoln, compiled and edited by Josephine Banner and Evelyn Dressman. Letter from Robert Handsworthy, Boonesboro, Maryland.
He is just one, and the weight of it about to kill me. Have exported this grief some 3,000 times so far to date. A mountain of boys, someone's boys, must keep on with it. May not have the heart for it. One thing to pull the lever when blind to the result. But here lies one dear example of what I accomplish by the orders I may not have the heart for it. What to do? Call a halt? Toss down the loss hole, those 3,000? Sue for peace? Become great course-reversing fool? King of indecision? Laughing stock for the ages, waffling hick, slim Mr. Turnabout? It is out of control. Who is doing it? Who caused it? Whose arrival on the scene began it? What am I doing? What am I doing here? Everything nonsense now. Those mourners came up, hands extended, sons intact, wearing on their faces enforced sadness masks to hide any sign of their happiness, which went on. They could not hide how alive they yet were with it, with their happiness at the potential of their still-living sons. Until lately I was one of them, strolling, whistling through the slaughterhouse, averting my eyes from the carnage, able to laugh and dream and hope because it had not yet happened to me. To us. Trap. Horrible trap. At one's birth it is sprung. Some last day must arrive, when you will need to get out of this body, bad enough. Then we bring a baby here. The terms of the trap are compounded. That baby also must depart. All pleasures should be tainted by that knowledge. But hopeful, dear us, we forget. Lord, what is this? All of this walking about, trying, smiling, bowing, joking. This sitting down at table, pressing of shirts, tying of ties, shining of shoes, planning of trips, singing of songs in the bath. When he is to be left out here. Is a person to nod, dance, reason, walk, discuss? As before. A parade passes. He can't rise and join. Am I to run after it, take my place, lift knees high, wave a flag, blow a horn? Was he dear or not? Then let me be happy no more.
49.
It was quite cold. Being in the gentleman, we were, for the first time in
ever so long,
quite cold ourselves.
He sat distraught and shivering, seeking about for any consolation. He must either be in a happy place or some null place by now, thought the gentleman. In either case, is no longer suffering, suffered so terribly at the end. The racking cough, the trembling, the vomiting, the pathetic attempts to keep the mouth wiped with a shaky hand, the way his panicked eyes would steal up and catch mine as if to say, "Is there really nothing, Papa, you can do?" And in his mind, the gentleman stood, we stood with him, on a lonely plain, screaming at the top of our lungs. Quiet then, in a great weariness. All over now. He is either in joy or nothingness. So why grieve? The worst of it for him is over. Because I loved him so, and am in the habit of loving him, and that love must take the form of fussing and worry and doing. Only there is nothing left to do. Free myself of this darkness as I can. Remain useful, not go mad. Think of him when I do as being in some bright place, free of suffering, resplendent in a new mode of being. Thus thought the gentleman, thoughtfully combing a patch of grass with his hand.
50.
Sad.
Very sad.
Especially given what we knew.
His boy was not in some bright place, free of suffering.
No.
Not resplendent in a new mode of being.
Au contraire.
Above us, an errant breeze loosened many storm-broken branches,
which fell to the earth at various distances,
as if the woods were full of newly roused creatures.
I wonder, said Mr. Volman, and I knew what was coming.
51.
We wished the lad to go, and thereby save himself. His father wished him to be in some bright place, free of suffering, resplendent in a new mode of being. A happy confluence of wishes. It seemed we must persuade the gentleman to return with us to the White Stone home. Once there, we must encourage the lad into the gentleman, hoping that, while therein, having overheard his father's wish, he would be convinced to—
A fine idea, I said, but we have no method by which to accomplish it.
There has historically been some confusion around this issue.
No confusion at all, friend. It is simply not within our power to communicate with those of that ilk, much less persuade them to do anything. And I think you know it.
52.
I beg to differ. We caused a wedding once, if you will recall.
Highly debatable.
A couple strolling here on the brink of ending their engagement reversed their decision under our influence.
Almost certainly a coincidence.
Several of us, Hightower, the three of us, and what was his name, the decapitated fellow?
Ellers.
Ellers, of course. Bored, we swarmed and entered that couple, and, through the combined force of our concentrated wishfulness, were able to effect—
This much is true. They were overcome with sudden passion and retreated behind one of the stone homes.
To act upon said passion.
While we watched.
I have misgivings about that. The watching.
Well, you had no misgivings on that day, my dear fellow. Your member was swollen to an astonishing size. And even on a normal day, it is swollen to—
I seem to remember you watching as well. I do not recall the slightest aversion of any of your many, many—
Truly, it was invigorating to see such passion. The fury of their embraces was remarkable.
Yes. They sent birds winging from the trees with their terrific moans of pleasure.
After which they renewed their commitment and departed, hand in hand, reconciled, betrothed again.
And we had done it.
Come now, they were young, lustful, alone in an isolated spot on a beautiful spring night. They hardly needed any help from—
Friend, we are here. Already here. Within. A train approaches a wall at a fatal rate of speed. You hold a switch in your hand that accomplishes you know not what. Do you throw it? Disaster is otherwise assured. It costs you nothing. Why not try?
53.
There in the gentleman, Mr. Bevins reached for my hand.
And we began.
To persuade the gentleman.
To attempt to persuade him.
Together, the two of us began to think of the White Stone home.
Of the boy.
His face, his hair, his voice.
His gray suit.
Turned in feet.
Scuffed shoes.
Stand up. Go back, we thought as one. Your boy requires your counsel.
He is in grave danger.
It is anathema for children to tarry here.
His headstrong nature, a virtue in that previous place, imperils him here, where the natural law, harsh and arbitrary, brooks no rebellion, and must be scrupulously obeyed.
We request, therefore, that you rise.
And return with us to save your boy.
It did not seem to be working.
The gentleman just sat, combing the grass, rather blank-minded.
It seemed we must be more direct.
We turned our minds by mutual assent to a certain shared memory of Miss Trainor.
Christmas last, paying a holiday visit, we found that, under the peculiar strain of that blessed holiday, she had gone beyond the fallen bridge. The vulture, the large dog, the terrible hag gorging on black cake, the stand of flood-ravaged corn, the umbrella ripped open by a wind we could not feel.
And was manifesting as an ancient convent containing 15 bitter, quarreling nuns about to burn to the ground.
A girl-sized convent in the style of a Greda, the little nuns inside her just embarking on morning vespers.
Suddenly the place, the girl, is ablaze, screams, shrieks, grunts, vows renounced, if only one might be saved.
But none are saved. All are lost.
We willed ourselves to see it again, smell it again, hear it again. The incense, the fragrant wall-lining sage bushes, the rose-scented breeze wafting down from the hill, the shrill nun screams, the padding of the tiny nun feet against the packed red clay of the town-bound trail.
Nothing.
He just sat.
Now, together, we became aware of something.
In his left trouser pocket.
A lock.
The lock from the white stone home.
Heavy and cold. Key still in it.
He had forgotten to rehang it.
An opportunity to simplify our argument.
We focused our attention upon the lock.
Upon the perils of an unlocked door.
I called to mind Fred Downs, raging in frustration as those drunken anatomy students tossed his bag sick form onto their cart, horses rearing with alarm at the smell.
I pictured the wolf-rended torso of Mrs. Scoville, tilted against her doorframe, one arm torn away, little veil fluttering in what remained of her white hair. Imagined the wolves massing in the woods even now, sniffing the breeze. Making for the white stone home, snarling, drooling, bursting in, etc.
The gentleman put his hand into that pocket.
Closed it upon the lock.
Shook his head unhappily. How could I have forgotten such a simple...
Got to his feet.
And walked off.
In the direction of the white stone home.
Leaving Mr. Volman and me there, behind him on the ground.
54.
Had we done it?
It seemed that perhaps we had.
55.
Because we were as yet intermingled with one another, traces of Mr. Volman naturally began arising in my mind, and traces of me naturally began arising in his.
Never having found ourselves in that configuration before...
This effect was an astonishment.
I saw, as if for the first time, the great beauty of the things of this world. Water drops in the woods around us plopped from leaf to ground. The stars were low, blue-white, tentative. The wind scent bore traces of fire, dryweed, river muck. The tisking dry bush rattles swelled with a peaking breeze as some distant cross-creek sleigh nag tossed its neck bells.
I saw his Anna's face and understood his reluctance to leave her behind.
I desired the man-smell and the strong hold of a man.
I knew the printing press loved operating it, new platen, roller hook, gripper bar, chase bed, recalled my disbelief as a familiar center beam came down, that fading, final, panicked instant. I have crashed through my desk with my chin. Someone, Mr. Pitts, screams from the anteroom. My bust of Washington lies about me, shattered.
The stove ticks. In my thrashing panic, I have upended a chair. The blood, channeled within the floorboard interstices, pools against the margins of the next room rug. I may yet be revived. Who has not made a mistake? The world is kind, it forgives, it is full of second chances. When I broke Mother's vase, I was allowed to sweep the fruit cellar. When I spoke unkindly to Sophia, our maid, I wrote her a letter, and all was well.
As soon as tomorrow, if I can only recover, I will have her. I will sell the shop, we will travel. In many new cities I will see her in dresses of many colors, which will drop to many floors. Friends already, we will become much more, will work every day to expand the frontiers of our happiness, as she once so beautifully put it. And there may be children yet. I am not so old, only 46, and she is in the prime of her...
Why had we not done this before?
So many years I had known this fellow, and yet had never really known him at all.
It was intensely pleasurable.
But was not helping.
The gentleman was gone, headed back to the Whitestone home.
Impelled by us.
Oh, wonderful night!
I exited Mr. Volman.
Upon Mr. Bevan's exit, I was immediately filled with longing for him and his associated phenomena, a longing that rivaled the longing I had felt for my parents when I first left their home for my apprenticeship in Baltimore, a considerable longing indeed. Such had been the intensity of our cohabitation. I would never fail to fully see him again. Dear Mr. Bevins.
Dear Mr. Volman. I looked at him. He looked at me.
We would be infused with some trace of one another forevermore.
But that was not all.
We seemed now to know the gentleman as well.
Removed from both Volman and the gentleman, I felt arising within me a body of startling new knowledge. The gentleman was Mr. Lincoln. Mr. Lincoln was president. How could it be? How could it not be? And yet I knew with all my heart that Mr. Taylor was president.
That Mr. Polk occupied that esteemed office.
And yet I knew with all my heart that Mr. Lincoln was president. We were at war. We were not at war. All was chaos. All was calm. A device had been invented for distant communication. No such device existed, nor ever could. The notion was mad. And yet I had seen it, had used it, could hear in my mind the sound it made as it functioned. It was telegraph. My God!
On the day of the beam, Polk had been president. But now I knew, with a dazzling clarity, that Polk had been succeeded by Taylor, and Taylor by Fillmore, and Fillmore by Pierce.
After which Pierce had been succeeded by Buchanan, and Buchanan by...
Lincoln.
President Lincoln.
The rail line ran beyond Buffalo now.
Far beyond.
The Duke of York nightcap is no longer worn. There is something called the slashed Pamela sleeve.
The theaters are lit now with gaslight, strip lights, and ground rows being employed in this process.
The resulting spectacle is a wonder.
Has revolutionized the theater.
The facial expressions of the actors are seen most clearly.
Allowing for an entirely new level of realism in the performance.
It would be difficult to express the perplexity these revelations thrust upon us.
We turned and ran, skimmed back toward the Whitestone home, talking most excitedly.
Mr. Bevan's hair and numerous eyes, hands, and noses, velocity streaming behind him.
Mr. Volman bearing his tremendous member in his hand so as not to trip himself on it.
Soon we were in Mr. Lincoln's lee, so close we could smell him.
Soap, pomade, pork, coffee, smoke.
Milk. Incense. Leather.
Book 2. 56.
The night of February 25th, 1862, was cold but clear, a welcome respite from the terrible weather the capital city had been experiencing. Willie Lincoln was now interred, and all ceremonial activities associated with that activity concluded. The nation held its breath, hopeful the president could confidently reassume the wheel of the ship of state in this, its hour of greatest need.
In The Spiritual Lincoln, An Essential Journey by C.R. DePage. 57.
By 2 a.m., the president had not yet returned to the White House. I considered waking Mrs. Lincoln, although it was not unusual for the president to ride out alone evenings. He would routinely refuse any escort. Tonight he had ridden Little Jack, of whom he was fond. The night was cold and wet. He had not taken his greatcoat, which still hung on the peg. He would be chilled when he returned, that much was certain, although his constitution was strong. I took up my post near the door, now and then stepping out to listen for Little Jack's trod. Another half hour passed, and still no Mr. Lincoln. If I were in his shoes, I thought, I might keep riding and never come back until I had ridden myself back west into a life of less import and trouble. When 3 a.m. had come and gone, I began to think he might have done just that. I again considered waking Mrs. Lincoln, but pity forbade me. She was in a very poor state. I found it strange that he should have left her alone at such a time. But she was heavily sedated and, I think, not aware that he was gone.
Hilliard Opsit, account of Paul Riles, White House Guard. 58.
Mary Lincoln's mental health had never been good, and the loss of young Willie ended her life as a functional wife and mother.
In A Mother's Trial, Mary Lincoln and the Civil War by Jane Coster.
Around 2 in the afternoon, I heard a terrible commotion from the part of the house where the sick child lay. It appeared the moment had come. Mrs. Lincoln rushed past me, head lowered, making a sound I have never heard emitted from human throat, before or since.
Hilliard Opsit, account of Sophie Lennox made.
While the president's outburst allowed for depiction, his wife's did not.
Epstein Opsit.
The pale face of her dead boy threw her into convulsions.
Keckley Opsit.
Mary Lincoln collapsed into her bed.
Von Drayley Opsit.
An altered woman.
Keckley Opsit.
Laudanum being administered, even this powerful concoction could not suppress her cries of agony or subdue her disbelieving outrage.
Coster Opsit.
Mrs. Lincoln was too ill to attend the funeral services.
Leach Opsit.
Mary Lincoln stayed abed for a full 10 days following the funeral.
In A Bell Remade, The Journey of Mary Lincoln by Kevin Swarney.
Mrs. Lincoln was unable to leave her room or rise from bed for many weeks after the tragedy.
Sloane Opsit.
When she finally emerged a month later, she moved about mechanically, gazing at us as if we were strangers.
Hilliard Opsit, account of D. Strumport Butler.
Some blows fall too heavy upon those too fragile.
Coster Opsit.
There she lay, longing that the thing should not be so, now disbelieving that it had occurred, now convinced anew that it had. Always the same walls, bed things, cup, ceiling, windows. She could not rise and leave, the world outside too terrible now. She sipped of the drugged drink that was her only hope for peace.
Swarney Opsit.
Where was her boy? She kept asking. Where was he? Couldn't someone find him, bring him to her at once? Mustn't he yet be somewhere?
Hilliard Opsit, account of Sophie Lennox made. Fifty-nine.
All so quiet, dear brother. Only the fire popping, and dear Grace snoring from your old room, where I have put her, so she may more easily attend me on these difficult nights. The moonlight shows the premises across the way littered far and wide with the detritus of yesterday's great storm. Mighty tree limbs lay against crypts and across graves. You may recall a certain statue of a bald man in Roman garb, whom we used to call Morty, standing with one foot on the neck of a snake, and that once a certain mischievous young fellow threw his sweater up there many times until Morty might catch it upon the end of his sword. Well, Morty is no more, or at least is not the man he once was. A falling limb hit that brave Roman at the arm, and off it came, sword and all, taking off the head of the snake on its way down. Now arm and sword and snake had lie in a heap. And Morty himself, as if shaken by this proof of his immortality, stands a bit askew on his base. Must have dozed a bit just now. Yes, it is nearly 4. There is a horse over there, across the way, tied to the cemetery fence. A calm and exhausted fellow, nodding as if to say, well, though I find myself at the yard of the dead in the dark of night, I am horse, and must obey. So now I have a mystery to distract me. Who could be over there at such a late hour? Some young gentleman, I hope, paying homage to a true love lost. The light burns in Mander's little guardhouse, and he paces back and forth before the window, as is his habit. You may recall that it was he who mounted a ladder to retrieve the aforementioned sweater from Morty's sword. He is older now and looks it, burdened, I think, with many family concerns, and now leaves the guardhouse, his lantern light receding. He is seeking, I imagine, our midnight visitor. All very intriguing. Whoever might think that an impairment such as mine disallows excitement? I wish that individual could sit here beside me at this window tonight. I will stay awake, I think, and see if I may glimpse the face of our visitor once Manders retrieves the fellow.
60.
Left behind on the roof of the Whitestone home, I resolved to make one final attempt to talk sense to the boy, who lay nearly insensate at my feet like a dazed and fallen Pasha prince. My feelings had been hurt by the juvenile, deceptive actions of Mr. Bevins and Mr. Volman, who, in their rush to chase after the slightest amusement, had left me in a very bad position indeed. Like some sort of primitive gardener, I worked, bent at the waist, seizing at tendrils with both hands. I must continually be deciding whether to attack the several already attached or take on their new arising brethren. In truth, it mattered not what I did. The boy's time was not long. An opportunity soon presented for a frank moment with him. Scanning the horizon for the feckless Bevins and Volman, I saw instead, creeping out of the woods, the Crutcher brothers, accompanied as usual by Mr. and Mrs. Reedy, the 4 of them comprising the core group of that depraved, orgiastic cohort that resided near the flagpole. "We come to watch," said Matt Crutcher. "The decline," said Richard Crutcher. "It is of interest to us," said Mrs. Reedy. "We watched it last time," said Matt Crutcher, "with that gal." "Found it most stimulating," said Mr. Reedy. "Really gave us a boost," said Mrs. Reedy. "And everyone needs a boost," said Mr. Reedy. "In this dunghole," said Matt Crutcher. "Don't judge us," said Mr. Reedy. "Or do," said Mrs. Reedy. "Makes us feel naughtier," said Matt Crutcher. "To each their own," said Richard Crutcher, stepping over close to Mrs. Reedy. "Perhaps," said Mrs. Reedy, slipping her hand into his pants pocket. The group now fell into a watchful, rapacious squat. Disgusting vultures, drawn here by the boy's misfortune, and soon got up to some strange cross-handed business, manifesting as one terrible creature, their pumping arms and rhythmic gasping conveying a distinctly mechanical impression. "What do you think?" I said to the boy. "Is this a good place? A healthy place? Do these people seem sane to you and worthy of emulation? And yet, here you are," the boy said. "I am different," I said. "From me?" he said. "From everyone," I said. "Different how?" he said. And I teetered on the brink of telling him.
61.
"For I am different, yes. Unlike these, Bevins, Volman, the dozens of other naifs I reside here among, I know very well what I am. Am not sick, not lying on a kitchen floor, not being healed via sick box, not waiting to be revived. No.
Even there at the end, in our guest room, with the view of the bricks of the Rednell house next door, upon which there hung a flowering vine, it was early June. The stable and grateful state of mind I had tried to cultivate all my life, via my ministry, left me in a state of acceptance and obedience, and I knew very well what I was. I was dead. I felt the urge to go. I went. Yes. Simultaneously becoming cause and awed observer, from within, of the bone-chilling fire sound associated with the matter-light blooming phenomenon, an experience I shall not even attempt to describe, I went. And found myself walking along a high mountain trail, preceded by two men who, I understood, had passed only seconds before. One wore a funeral suit of a very cheap type, and looked this way and that, like a tourist, and was rather oddly humming, in a way that communicated a sense of vacuous happiness, willful ignorance. Though he was dead, his attitude seemed to be, "Ha-ha! What's all this, then?" The other wore a yellow bathing costume, had a beard of flaming red, moved along angrily as if in a hurry to get somewhere he very much resented going. The former man was from Pennsylvania, the latter from Maine, Bangor or thereabouts. Had spent much time in farm fields and often made his way to the coast to sit for hours on the rocks. He wore a bathing costume because he had drowned while swimming. Somehow I knew this. Periodically, as I made my way down that trail, I was also back here, was in my grave, was startled out of my grave by the sight of what lay in my coffin. That prim-looking, dry-faced relic was above my grave, nervously walk-skimming about it. My wife and congregation were saying their final goodbyes, their weeping driving small green daggers into me, literal daggers. With each sob, a dagger left the griever and found its way into me, most painfully. Then I was back there, upon that trail with my two friends. Below us lay a distant valley that I somehow knew to be our destination. A set of stone steps became visible. My companions paused, glanced back. Recognizing me as a man of God, I had been buried in my vestments, they seemed to be asking, should we proceed? I indicated that we should. From the valley below, chanting of some sort, excited voices, the clanging of a bell. These sounds contented me. We had journeyed, had arrived. The festivities might now begin. I was filled with happiness that my life had been judged worthy of such a spectacular denouement. Then vexingly, I was back here. My wife and congregation now departing in coaches, occasionally sending forth the random green dagger, the impact of which did not lessen no matter how far they drove. Soon my mourners had crossed the Potomac and were eating the funeral meal at Previe's. I knew this even as I paced back and forth before my grave. I became panicked at the prospect of becoming stranded here, wished only to rejoin my friends there, on that stairway. This place was now entirely unappealing, a boneyard, a charnel ground, a garbage dump, a sad remnant of a discouraging and grossly material nightmare from which I was only just waking. Instantaneously, with that very thought, I was there again, with my friends, coming off those stairs into a sun-drenched meadow in which stood a large structure unlike any I had ever seen, built of interlocking planks and wedges of purest diamond, giving off an array of colors that changed of the instant with any slight variation in the quality of the sunshine. We approached arm in arm. A crowd gathered about us, ushering us along. An honor guard stood by the door, beaming at our approach. The door flew open. Inside, a vast expanse of diamond floor led to a single diamond table, at which sat a man I knew to be a prince not Christ, but Christ's direct emissary. The room was reminiscent of Hartley's warehouse, a place I had known as a boy. A tremendous open space, high-ceilinged and forbidding, made more forbidding by the presence of an authority figure, Hartley himself in those early days, that Christ emissary now, seated near a source of heat and light, a fireplace then, a jagged topaz now, on fire from within, upon a stand of pure gold. We understood that we were to step forth in our previous order. Our red-bearded friend, ridiculous in his bathing costume, went first. Appearing now from either side, walking in perfect step with him as he approached the table, were two beings, beautiful in appearance, tall, thin, luminous, born on feet of sun-yellow light. "How did you live?" one asked. "Tell it truthfully," the other said, as from either side they gently touched their heads to his. Both beamed with pleasure at what they found within. "May we confirm?" said the one on their right. "Sure," said our red-bearded friend, "and I hope you will, too." The yellow-footed being on the right sang out a single joyful note, and several smaller versions of himself danced out. I use this word to denote the utter grace of their movements, bearing a large mirror, the edges of which were encrusted with precious gems. The yellow-footed being on the left sang his single joyful note, and several smaller versions of himself tumbled out, rolling forth in the most exquisite sequence of gymnastic movements imaginable, bearing a scale. "Quick check," said Christ's emissary from his seat at the diamond table. The being on the right held the mirror up before the red-bearded fellow. The being on the left reached into the red-bearded man's chest, and with a deft and somehow apologetic movement, extracted the man's heart and placed it on the scale. The being on the right checked the mirror. The being on the left checked the scale. "Very good," said the Christ emissary. "We are so happy for you," said the being on the right, and I cannot adequately describe the sound of rejoicing that echoed then from across what I now understood to be a vast kingdom extending in all directions around the palace. A tremendous set of diamond doors at the far end of the hall flew open, revealing an even vaster hall.